Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.24, The Ottoman Spring. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. My break was a bit longer than anticipated, but as I've said before, that's just what happens when you have a one-year-old. You look up and suddenly a whole month has passed, but I am quite excited to be back at it here, and I've got some exciting announcements coming up soon, so keep an eye on the feed for that. Last time, we sat back and watched as the CUP launched their long-awaited mutiny and assassination campaign against Sultan Abdulhamid. And these CUP actions knocked down the first domino of what would end up being a cascade of revolutionary unrest in the European lands of the Ottoman Empire. And so, within just a few weeks after the revolutionary officers Ismail Enver and Ahmed Niazi led their mutinous bands into the hills of Monastir, nearly the entirety of the Ottoman Balkans had come under the unofficial rule of the CUP. And then, after a mass demonstration of Albanians in Kosovo led to Albanian notables demanding constitutional rule, the Sultan could see the way the winds were blowing, and Abdulhamid would announce the reinstatement of the Midhat Constitution and the supposed end of autocratic rule on the night of July the 23rd to 24th, 1908. In the days immediately following this imperial proclamation of Sultan Abdulhamid, announcing the reinstatement of the Midhat Constitution, large crowds would gather in the public squares and outside town halls and in the cafes and restaurants of the major cities throughout the Ottoman Empire. These celebrations would begin in Macedonia, Albania, and Thrace, where the revolution had actually taken place. But then they would quickly spread eastwards to Izmir, Jerusalem, Cairo, Adana, Erzurum, Damascus, and of course, Istanbul itself. But perhaps no single place witnessed a more jubilant and raucous celebration than that seen in the Macedonian port city of Salonika, headquarters of the Committee of Union and Progress and home to the Sacred Committee of the CUP, who had largely masterminded the events of July 1908. Sitting on the glittering Aegean in Salonika's main harbor is Olympus Square, where jubilant crowds waved red, white, and green flags emblazoned with the Ottoman crescent. And as band musicians played La Marseillaise, spectators chanted revolutionary slogans, the most common being liberty, equality, solidarity, justice. And demonstrators held up photographs of the newly declared heroes of liberty, the junior officers Ismail Enver and Ahmed Niazi, who had taken their bands into the hills of Monastir and had thereafter launched the Constitutional Revolution of 1908. The residents of Salonika, the cosmopolitan melting pot home to a truly dizzying diversity of ethnic, religious, and linguistic groups, all gathered together on that sacred day to embrace one another and to weep and laugh and drink and cry and shout and sing, and to let out one giant collective sigh of relief. The fear was over. The days of tyranny and violence and surveillance and chaos were behind them. The days of liberty were now at hand. A centerpiece of Olympus Square in Salonika was the Olympus Hotel that had long been owned and operated by a prominent family within the Dunme community, those Jewish Muslim converts that had come to dominate Salonika in recent years, economically and politically, and whose community leaders had helped the revolutionary cause through offering up their houses as hideouts and secret meeting places. And many younger Dunme, such as Mehmet Javid, had been early members of the CUP and had played a central role in the conspiracy to challenge the Sultan. So, out on the steps of the Olympus Hotel, symbolic center of the Dunme community, CUP leaders, junior officers from the Third Army, prominent liberal journalists, influential town notables, and other supporters of the revolution took turns giving patriotic speeches to a crowd of onlookers who listened with rapt attention. One such speech was given by the Jewish journalist Moise Cohen, who would later change his name to Munis Tekinalp, and who, like many Jews from Salonika, would offer his undying support to the CUP following the revolution. Moise Cohen would declare, quote, "We want brotherhood between all peoples. We are all one without regard to religion or sect. Long live the fatherland. Long live freedom. There are no Greeks, Jews, or Bulgarians. There are only Ottomans." After such patriotic speeches, the diverse crowd would burst out in rapturous applause, with people from all walks of life embracing one another in a show of mutual solidarity. Amidst this delirium, Greek and Bulgarian church leaders would take to the stage and shake hands and hug one another to demonstrate the reconciliation between their peoples, who had been engaged in that brutal conflict called the Macedonian Struggle for over a decade. The gendarme commander of Salonika would describe this intoxicating atmosphere as follows, quote, "A cry of joy burst from every lung in the crowd, and you could see Muslims, Greeks, and Bulgarians, the old mortal enemies, falling into one another's arms. An indescribable delirium ensued as the reconciliation of the races and religions was consecrated underneath an immense flag emblazoned with the words, 'Long live the Constitution.'" And then one French observer would similarly recall, quote, "Yesterday, massacre and words of hate. Today, the unanimous joy of liberty and fraternity. We could hardly believe our eyes and ears. After having witnessed 5 years of carnage and horrors, we believed we were living in a dream. And yet it was unquestionably reality. This new situation, created by the committee, responded well to the secret sentiments of all the populations, whatever their race and religion. Everyone thirsted for a little peace and tranquility." Later that night, Major Ismail Enver would arrive by train to Salonika, and at the platform, the hero of liberty was greeted by his fellow CUP committeemen, the inspector of the Rumelia Railways, Ahmed Jemal, and the revolutionary mailman and budding leader of the CUP's sacred committee, Mehmet Talat. Jemal and Talat embraced Enver as he stepped off the train, and they allegedly exclaimed, "Enver, you are now Napoleon." Then Enver, Talat, and Jemal, the three men who would, in 5 years' time, consolidate their dictatorial triumvirate over the empire as the so-called Three Pashas, would themselves make their way to the city center of Salonika, where Enver was welcomed by a euphoric crowd. Enver was quickly emerging as the revolution's most charismatic leader, and when the hero of liberty ascended to the platform, he declared, quote, "Citizens, today the arbitrary ruler is gone. Bad government is no more. We are all brothers. There are no Bulgars, Albanians, Greeks, Serbs, Romanians, Jews, or Muslims. Under the blue sky, we are all equal. We are proud to be Ottomans." Perhaps the most astonishing development amidst the jubilation of late July 1908 came when Christian guerrilla leaders began to come out of their hideouts in the Macedonian wilderness to declare their allegiance to the new constitutional regime. As these Christian revolutionaries entered Salonika, Monastir, and other cities throughout Macedonia, they would ceremoniously turn over their weapons and symbolically declare an end to the Macedonian struggle that had defined life for Ottomans living in the Balkans for over a decade now. And one of the leaders of this movement amongst the Christian guerrillas was our old friend Jan Sandanski, whom you may remember was the MRO leader who had organized the kidnapping of the American Protestant missionary Ellen Stone. Well, in the years following the Ilinden Uprising and the death of Gotze Delchev, when the MRO had split into two competing factions, Sandanski had emerged as the leader of the left wing of the MRO, which carried on the legacy of Gotze Delchev and continued to push for a multi-ethnic socialist Balkan confederation in the 5 years between 1903 and 1908. Jan Sandanski and his guerrilla band, which had been operating in the Macedonian wilderness for nearly a decade, would first travel to the town of Seris, where Sandanski symbolically embraced the Greek bishop before an enraptured crowd to signal that the struggle between Greeks and Macedo-Bulgarians was now at an end. Sandanski would then travel down to Salonika, where he would declare his allegiance to the new constitutional regime. And in front of another raucous crowd, Sandanski and his band would destroy all of their weapons to show the people that they were turning away from violent revolutionary politics and preparing themselves for peaceful parliamentary politics. After they had destroyed their weapons, Sandanski would offer a proclamation to all nations of the empire, saying, quote, "Our fatherland, so sorely tired, is celebrating its rebirth. The revolutionary appeal of our young Turkish brothers has echoed joyously in the souls of equally sorely tired people. To my Turkish compatriots, you represent the great majority of the people, and you have therefore carried the greatest weight of our mutual enemy's oppression. In your Turkish empire, you were no less slaves than your Christian counterparts. Dear Christian compatriots, you were also cruelly deceived in your belief that your suffering at the hands of tyranny was caused by the entire Turkish people. Dear friends, do not allow yourself to be influenced by the criminal agitation which may be used by official Bulgaria to undermine your joint struggle with the Turkish people and the peaceful continuation of this struggle." So, in the streets of nearly every town and city throughout Ottoman Europe, in Macedonia, Albania, Kosovo, Thrace, Ottomans from all walks of life, whether they be Turks, Bulgarians, Serbs, Greeks, Vlachs, Jews, Donme, Romani, Albanians, or Armenians, came together to celebrate the arrival of a new age that everyone hoped would be defined by equality, liberty, justice, solidarity, and really above all else, peace. The diverse peoples of the Ottoman Balkans were openly embracing a new cosmopolitan and democratic future in the hope that this new embrace of all the diverse elements of Ottoman lands would finally put an end to years of endless violence. A writer named Leon Sciacchi, who came from a prominent Sephardic Jewish family in Salonika and who was 14 years old during the revolution, would some years later wistfully recall the summer of 1908 and capture this hope for a more peaceful and inclusive future, saying, quote, "It was to be the end of discrimination and injustice. It was to be the end of internecine struggles and bloodshed, the end of hatreds. They were tired of hating, these people. They wanted to live in peace. Life was something else than constant feud between people speaking different tongues. It was time to work hand in hand for the good of all." Knowing what is to come in the years following the Young Turk Revolution, it is easy to view all of this euphoria as hopelessly naive. To see this utopian belief in the great potential of Ottomanism and cosmopolitan democracy as just doomed to fail from the very beginning. But to think in this way would be to overburden this historical moment with the benefit of hindsight. Our view of the past is always colored by what ends up happening, and this fact makes it quite difficult, if not impossible, to understand the overwhelming sense of endless possibilities felt by a people emerging from decades of political repression, fear, and violence. Life for everyday Ottomans, especially for those living in the European lands of the Ottoman Empire, had been defined by the constant presence of the Sultan's secret police, who might at any moment come knocking at your door, by the ongoing meddling of European imperialists looking over your shoulder and condescendingly telling you how backward your people are, and then most of all, by the looming threat of violence and terror, which might break out at any moment as part of the ongoing life-or-death struggle in Macedonia between Bulgarian, Greek, Serbian, and more recently Albanian and Turkish guerrillas. So, for the people of Ottoman Europe, who had been subjected to this immense suffering for so long, to be told that all the hardships were now over was incredibly intoxicating. And honestly, these few months of joy and celebration in Ottoman lands following the revolution of July 1908 are a real testament to the seemingly innate human desire for just joyous camaraderie amongst one's fellow human beings. Now, one of the most striking and commented upon aspects of the Young Turk Revolution is this seemingly oversized reaction on the part of the general Ottoman public following the CUP mutiny. Because it is often noted by historians that the actual events of July 1908 were in some ways a bit underwhelming. As we saw last episode, the revolution itself consisted of just a few hundred committeemen conspiring with a couple thousand revolutionary officers, who had essentially launched an army mutiny within a single corps, and then had initiated an assassination campaign against hated public officials. There was no general strike, or large popular uprising, or dramatic insurrection, or storming of a great prison, or even a mass demonstration in the imperial capital. And when you compare the Young Turk Revolution to something like the Alinden Uprising, which was a popular mass uprising and which had occurred only 5 years earlier in the exact same areas of Macedonia, the Alinden Uprising kind of dwarfs the Young Turk Revolution, as some estimates claim the Alinden Uprising included over 20,000 rebels, while the Young Turk Revolution was the work of just a few thousand conspirators. So when Western observers began to hear about the events of July 1908, they would see pictures of these large multi-ethnic crowds holding signs with French revolutionary slogans, and many assumed, understandably, that these demonstrations had been the driving force behind the revolution. But these large crowds had not emerged until after the Constitution had been reinstated. They were a celebration of an already established fact, rather than a precipitating revolutionary event. Now, the big exception to this rule was the Firchevik gathering that we talked about last time, in which thousands of Albanians gathered in Kosovo to demand the reinstatement of parliamentary rule. This large gathering of tens of thousands of Albanians occurred simultaneously with the mutinies in the Third Army, and both of these events were absolutely critical in compelling the Sultan to capitulate to the CUP's demands. But the other demonstrations throughout the empire, especially the festivities in the imperial capital in Istanbul, played no role whatsoever in forcing Abdülhamid to capitulate. And in fact, a lot of the demonstrators, both in Istanbul and elsewhere, did not only chant liberty, equality, solidarity, and justice, but also long live the Sultan. And amongst the demonstrators, just as common as the pictures of the heroes of liberty, Enver and Niazi, were pictures of Sultan Abdülhamid. And though it might seem weird that Abdülhamid, whom nearly all the revolutionaries had openly derided as the Red Sultan, would now be heralded as a lover of freedom, you have to remember that the Sultan had been the one who actually issued the imperial decree announcing the reinstatement of parliamentary rule. And then, in early August, just a week after the revolution, Abdülhamid would issue a general amnesty for political exiles and political prisoners, and he would lift censorship on newspapers, journals, and other publications within the empire. Now, was this a cynical move by Abdülhamid to try and steal the CUP's thunder in their moment of triumph? 100%! That's exactly what he was doing. But this is what Abdülhamid had always been really, really good at. He was, at this point, a very savvy politician, and he could see the way the winds were blowing. So the Sultan made a calculated decision to go with the current rather than against it. The Sultan's decision to capitulate in July 1908 likely saved his throne, at least for the time being. And for a brief moment, Abdülhamid enjoyed increased popularity, especially amongst pious Muslims, who still revered Abdülhamid as a spiritual and imperial authority. So, during these heady days in the summer of 1908, masses of people would celebrate the revolutionary achievements of not only the revolutionary officers of the CUP, but also of the Sultan himself. A little episode that can give you a flavor of the strange and somewhat surreal dynamic that would emerge between the CUP and the Sultan in late summer 1908 would come when a group of the primary CUP conspirators traveled to Istanbul to negotiate with Abdülhamid. Shortly after executing their revolution, the CUP would send a 7-man committee to Istanbul. This committee would include the revolutionary mailman, Mehmet Talat, the staff major and railway inspector, Ahmet Cemal, and the Donme economist, Mehmet Javid. While in Istanbul, the CUP delegation would use their newfound leverage to exert pressure on the Sultan and to force him to enact liberalizing reforms and to take measures to ensure that the upcoming elections would be fair and free. Following this meeting, the CUP men would comment upon the amazing transformation of the Sultan, who had seemingly overnight become an ardent lover of liberty and constitutionalism. Yes, that is right. Sultan Abdulhamid was now positioning himself as a benevolent and enlightened ruler, who had always been a lover of liberty, but who had just been forced by external factors at the beginning of his rule in 1878 to suspend the constitution. But now that the crisis was behind them, the always benevolent Sultan could now express his true love of liberalism and constitutionalism. Of course, this astonishing and overnight change in the Sultan's opinion of constitutions, I am sure had nothing to do with the fact that a large section of the army was now backing an increasingly strong oppositional party who was imposing demands on His Royal Highness. This unique arrangement in which the CUP would simply pressure the Sultan from behind the scenes instead of actually claiming official cabinet positions within the government would persist for several months leading up to and following the general elections of fall 1908. And one result of this unique arrangement was that a lot of people did not fully understand the true nature of the revolution. And many initially thought that the Sultan had simply decided that the Ottoman people were now ready for constitutional rule. Because, like we just said, this is how the Sultan presented it. So, it was only gradually that the vast majority of people began to realize that, in fact, a secretive and conspiratorial organization, potentially led by secular atheists, was, in fact, pulling the strings of government from behind the scenes. This slow realization of the true nature of the CUP's power would become very important leading up to the counter-revolution of 1909. But that is all for later. For now, people were just generally super amped about the revolution, and there was a pretty broadly shared sense of optimism and hope throughout Ottoman lands. The CUP had kicked down the door of Hamidian despotism, which had held the Ottoman people in a repressive and stagnant limbo for 3 decades. Once this door was kicked down and the constitution was the new law of the land, people went wild. And there was kind of nonstop partying throughout the empire, and this euphoric partying would last for days and even weeks. And then once the cumulative hangover from these heady days of freedom began to wear off, everyone began to do all of the things that one would expect people to do in a newly liberalized society. Censorship had been lifted, so this led to a veritable renaissance in Ottoman journalism and literature, as dozens of newspapers, journals, and publishing houses were started up, expressing all sorts of new opinions. Opinions that last week would have literally gotten you thrown into a prison or exiled to a remote province of Anatolia. Additionally, new political clubs, political parties, labor unions, fraternal brotherhoods, etc. began to form openly, and everyone got ready to participate in parliamentary politics. These parties would form along many different lines, be they ethnic, religious, or ideological. And the parliament would emerge as one of the most visible symbols of this great experiment now taking place in trying to build a pluralistic and cosmopolitan democracy in Ottoman lands. And at least initially, the parliament would truly represent the overwhelming diversity of the empire, as it would include Muslims, Christians, and Jews, and ethnically, there would be Turks, Albanians, Arabs, Kurds, Donme, Greeks, Bulgarians, Armenians, Serbs, Jews, and Aromanians. Though, as we have said before, oftentimes these delegates would not strongly identify with their given nationalities. And this would be especially true for the Muslim delegates, as Muslim Turks, Arabs, Albanians, and Kurds would be some of the most ardent supporters of Ottomanism. Then, ideologically, members of parliament would range from constitutional liberals to radical socialists to conservative Islamists to patriotic unionists and everything in between. Now, there would be certain patterns aligning these ideologies with different ethno-religious groups. Like, for example, the more radically left-wing delegates espousing liberalism or socialism were oftentimes Christian or Jewish, while the more conservative delegates tended to be Sunni Muslims. But even though these rough patterns did exist, there were countless exceptions to this rule, with Jewish delegates who were hardcore unionists, Muslim socialists, and conservative Orthodox Greeks. Now, as we move through the next few years, we are going to dive headlong into the nitty-gritty of parliamentary politics. But I do want to note a few individuals who would come to play a prominent role within the first parliament after it was convened in December 1908. Because what's fun about the fact that we have done all of these mini-series and talked in some detail about the Young Turks in opposition before 1908 is that we already know a ton of these delegates. For example, the most important party that would form in opposition to the CUP would be the Liberty Party, founded by old Prince Sabahadeen, and this party would follow Prince Sabahadeen's line and would generally push for decentralization, capitalist development, and liberalism. And then Ismail Kemal, who had stood right alongside Sabahadeen at the 1902 Congress of the Ottoman Opposition, and who would, in a few short years, help to found an independent Albania, would emerge as an important Albanian member of parliament. Then Armin Garo, who first gained fame as the leader of the Ottoman bank takeover during the height of the Hamidian massacres in 1896, would represent the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, the Dashnaks, who would become a legalized party after the revolution. And the Dashnaks would emerge as a force to be reckoned with in parliament due to their political experience, international influence, and entrenched party discipline. And then, even though he would not be officially elected to parliament, Jan Sandanski, leader of the left wing of the MRO, would be an important lobbyist and party organizer for the Macedo-Bulgarians. And then finally, the most important political party by far would be the CUP itself, which would dramatically grow in size in the months following July 1908 through the old bandwagon effect. CUP branches would be started up throughout the Ottoman Empire, and the Sacred Committee of the CUP, which would remain in Salonika under the leadership of Talat, Dr. Nazim, Dr. Shakir, Javed, Jamal, and others, would heavily influence Ottoman politics from this point on. Though, as we have mentioned, in the early days, this influence would remain largely behind the scenes, as the CUP would not initially fill any government ministries. Instead, the CUP would use their influence in the army, their vast conspiratorial network of fanatical supporters, and their parliamentary majority to pull the levers of government and to impose their will on the Sultan. Because the first parliament would be dominated by the CUP, as delegates would flock to the committee as it was the largest, most well-organized, and most successful political party following 1908. These members of the CUP would come from a fairly diverse background, with Muslims, Christians, and Jews representing the CUP, though the committee would come to be increasingly dominated by Turkish-speaking Sunni Muslims. Some of the CUP members who would be elected to parliament, who we have already come across, would be the Dunme economist Mehmet Javed, the prominent lawyer and Sephardic Jew from Salonika, Emmanuel Carasso, the two early members of the Ottoman Freedom Society, Mustafa Rami Arslan and Mithat Shukuru Bleda, and then, of course, the revolutionary Mehmed Mehmed Talat, whose growing influence would be shown through the fact that he would serve as the vice president of the first parliament. And then the president of the first parliament would be none other than Ahmed Reza, who would make a glorious return home to Istanbul in September of 1908. And upon his return, the positivist and anti-imperialist scholar would be heralded as the Father of Liberty, and alongside the Heroes of Liberty, officers Enver and Niazi, Ahmed Reza would, for better or for worse, become the face of the CUP, and of the broader revolutionary movement. Because due to his stubborn and principled resistance to the Red Sultan over the past 10-plus years, Ahmed Reza had long been the most well-known young Turk, so he would enjoy widespread popularity. Though, as we will see, this popularity would fade quite fast as we exit the honeymoon phase of the Young Turk Revolution. The return of Ahmed Reza to Istanbul was part of a larger influx of political exiles and prisoners back into Ottoman lands, as the Sultan was forced by the CUP to issue a general pardon. And after 30 years of the Sultan's despotic police state, there were so many political prisoners and exiles, and this general amnesty was a very dramatic event, as people's loved ones and comrades flooded back home to take part in the great renewal of their fatherland. Some of the most important of these exiles who would make a glorious return home would be Dr. Shakir, who, while living in Europe, had reorganized the CUP and made it into a truly revolutionary party. And then a bunch of Armenian revolutionaries in the Dashnak and Hunchak parties would return home, and these Armenian revolutionaries would now publish their journals openly and prepare to participate in electoral politics, primarily out in eastern Anatolia. And then Prince Sabahaddin would return, and like we have just said, he would quickly put together the Liberty Party. But the most anticipated return of all the political exiles was that of the Father of Liberty, Ahmed Reza. Like we have said, we are going to return to the nitty-gritty of the elections of 1908 and to the reintroduction of parliamentary politics to Ottoman lands. But before we move on, it is worth taking a moment to appreciate the incredible changes that have taken place within the political culture of the Ottoman Empire. Because not only were revolutionaries allowed to return home, but individuals like Armin Garo, Mehmed Talat, Ahmed Reza, Prince Sabahaddin, and Jan Sandanski, who had been public enemy number one literally yesterday, were now running for parliament. So, if anything, demonstrates the radical effects of the CUP's mutiny in July 1908. It is this fact that people who were sworn enemies of the state earlier that year, and even revolutionary terrorists and assassins, were now like being elected to parliament. Yeah, the revolution is definitely going down in Ottoman lands. Along with these revolutionary developments in the political sphere, with things like the freedom of the press and assembly, the introduction of parliamentary government, the deconstruction of the secret police and general amnesty, and so on, there were also some pretty dramatic social changes that would burst forth onto the scene in 1908 as well. And these rapid-fire changes to the social fabric of the empire, an empire which had, with some consistency, remained as a traditional society for centuries, would be some of the most visible revolutionary changes for everyday Ottomans. The most radical and divisive of these changes by far would be the loosening of gender norms and the introduction of women into the public sphere. This shift in the visibility of women would, for some, seemingly happen overnight, as women would openly participate in the raucous celebrations immediately following the revolution, and especially in urban centers like Salonika, Istanbul, Izmir, Edirne, and Monastir, where reformist elements had already gained some momentum prior to 1908. Women would take part in these festivities and openly celebrate their new status as Ottoman citizens, often abandoning their traditional wardrobes and appearing unveiled. The sight of unveiled women openly partying alongside men would shock the more conservative elements of Ottoman society. And the new visibility of women was one of the most widely discussed topics in the press coverage on the revolution. In this new world of liberalism, cosmopolitanism, and Ottomanism, women were assumed by many to be included within Ottoman citizenship. And in fact, for many CUP leaders, especially for intellectuals like Ahmed Reza, who had long held feminist sympathies, the introduction of women into the public sphere was seen as one of the most critical aspects in modernizing the Ottoman Empire and the Islamic world more generally. The open participation of women in society had long been viewed as one of the biggest differences between the Islamic world and Western Europe. So the increased participation of women in public society was a top priority for many revolutionaries. And as a result, Ottoman women began to organize political and social clubs and to start up newspapers, magazines, and journals. These publications would have large readership amongst the literate population, and previously tabooed topics surrounding gender were much more openly discussed within these magazines and journals. Generally speaking, under the new constitutional regime, more emphasis would be put on women's education and women's access to certain professions. And so, an increasing number of women would find work as teachers, nurses, and administrators, and many more women would attend universities. Even though the process of opening up the public sphere to Ottoman women had already begun as part of the reforms during the Tanzimat era, the shift in the role of women in society witnessed in the months and years following 1908 really was a radical break from the past, especially following the repressive reign of Abdülhamid. This process would accelerate during the early years of the Turkish Republic following 1923, as Mustafa Kemal Atatürk would put even more emphasis on ensuring the rights of women in Turkish society. And in the early years of the Republic, the feminist movement in Turkey would become somewhat intertwined within the broader Kemalist modernization program. So, in the broader picture, the challenge to traditional gender roles and norms was seen by modernizers in the Ottoman world as an essential component of their overall project. And well, the CUP were radical modernizers, and ensuring further civil and political rights for women was a critical component of the Young Turk Revolution. So, following 1908, women would become increasingly visible within Turkish society, and new feminist pioneers would emerge in many Ottoman ethnic communities, be they Armenian, Greek, Turkish, and so on. A good number of these early feminist pioneers had already made a name for themselves by 1908, and they would simply use the newfound freedoms after the revolution to more fully undertake their respective projects. For example, Selma Rıza, whom you may remember was Ahmed Rıza's sister, and who is usually credited as being the first female Turkish journalist, had been writing in CUP publications while living in exile in Paris for over a decade at this point. After Selma Rıza returned to Ottoman lands following 1908, she would turn towards humanitarian work and become the Secretary General for the Turkish Red Crescent. Then, two sisters from Istanbul, Amine Simiye and Fatma Aliya, would emerge as two of the most important female Turkish writers and activists. Amine and Fatma were both daughters of an important Tanzimat bureaucrat and intellectual named Ahmed Cevdet Pasha. Cevdet Pasha had actually spearheaded the effort to fuse together secular law with Sharia Islamic law, so he was a super important reformer during the Tanzimat, and an important voice within the larger movement of Islamic modernism, which we talked about in episode 2.14. So, Emine and Fatma grew up within this elite and somewhat liberal environment, and they would actually be fairly widely published during the reign of Sultan Abdülhamid. But what would change is that after the revolution, the two sisters would be much freer to say things that they actually thought. They would no longer have to include the expected deference to the Sultan, or the nods to traditional Islamic norms. This was more broadly true across the board, as prominent writers from the Hamidian era would continue to publish after 1908. But following the revolution, many would reveal that they had in fact had liberal sympathies all along. But it was only after the CUP had kicked down the door of Hamidian despotism that they were finally able to express their true feelings. Much like Selma Rıza, Emine Simiye had been an early member of the CUP, though while Selma lived in Paris with her brother Ahmed, Emine lived in Salonika, where she rubbed shoulders with members of the Sacred Committee like Talat and Javed. And according to some accounts, Emine was actually the first person to initiate the raucous demonstration in Salonika following the revolution. Throughout her career, which would extend well into the Republican era, Emine would use her voice as a writer, teacher, and playwright to push for the full emancipation of Turkish women, and she was especially focused on expanding women's education. And then, Emine's sister, Fatma, is often credited as being the very first female Turkish novelist, and some even say the first female novelist in the entire Islamic world, though that claim seems kind of hard to prove. Many commentators at the time and later would note that Fatma was generally more conservative than her sister. And during the early years of the Turkish Republic, Fatma would come to oppose the secularism of Mustafa Kemal, as she would push for an improvement in the status of women within an Islamic framework, placing her in the long tradition of Islamic modernism. Now, this position would not only place her as more conservative than her sister, Emine, but Fatma would also be way more conservative than the younger generation of Turkish feminists who would emerge after 1908. Because the revolution would open up space for an entire generation of Ottoman women to carve out a place for themselves in the public sphere. One such younger Turkish feminist was the novelist, Turkish nationalist, and future member of parliament during the Republican era, Halid Adib. Much like the aristocratic sisters, Emine and Fatma, Halid Adib was similarly born to an elite family from Istanbul, and Halid Adib received a liberal education from private tutors. Halid Adib is kind of a prototypical example of someone whose life was fundamentally altered as a result of the Young Turk Revolution, as Halid Adib would be directly inspired by the events of July 1908 to begin a career as a journalist and a novelist. Halid Adib was 24 years old during the dramatic events of 1908, so a good 20 years younger than the sisters Emine and Fatma. And the young Halid Adib would take full advantage of the newly freed press to publish many articles and essays in the new women's newspapers and magazines that began popping up. And then Halid Adib would publish her first novel in 1909. In the coming years, Halid Adib would become especially important as a public intellectual pushing for pan-Turkism and Turanism, movements that we are going to be talking a whole lot more about in the coming episodes. Halid Adib would push for pan-Turkism alongside CUP leaders like Talat, Dr. Shakir, Dr. Nazım, and Ziya Gökalp. This focus on pan-Turkism would make Halid Adib a controversial figure in the coming years. But, like I said, we will be talking a lot more about this shift from Ottomanism to Turkish nationalism in the coming episodes, because it will be super important. But, to sum it up, the 1908 revolution was especially inspiring for educated Muslim women, who would begin to take advantage of the liberalizing reforms and to push for the full emancipation of Ottoman women. And to give you a sense of the ways in which the euphoric optimism of 1908 inspired people from all levels of Ottoman society, I want to read you a quote from Halid Adib, in which she describes witnessing the elections of fall 1908, when thousands of people took to the streets in the cities across the empire to ceremoniously carry the election urns filled with the people's votes for parliament. Quote, "Masses of people followed the election urns, decked in flowers and flags. In carriages sat the Muslim and Christian priests, hand in hand. Christian and Muslim maidens, dressed in white, locked in childish embrace, passed on, while the crowd that followed sang enthusiastically, 'O country, O mother, be thou joyful and happy today.' The memory is so intense that to this day I cannot think of it unmoved. I think of it as a final embrace of love between the simple peoples of Turkey, before they should be led to exterminate each other for the political advantage of foreign powers or their own leaders." So, as we can see, the second half of 1908 was a time of intense optimism and euphoria in the Ottoman Empire, as people from all levels of society clamored to participate in this new world of freedom, democracy, and cosmopolitanism, all under the banner of Ottomanism. Now, I know we've covered a lot in this episode, so let's just quickly review some of the most momentous changes that would take place following the Revolution of 1908. First, we have the introduction of constitutional government and parliamentary politics. Second, you've got the destruction of the censorship regime and the subsequent emergence of a free press and of public opinion as a force within politics. Third, there was the general amnesty for political prisoners and exiles and the promise of a more free society in which the secret police would be dismantled and the rights of individual citizens would be protected. And then fourth, there was a radical challenge to traditional gender norms and the introduction of women into the public sphere. And finally, all of these reforms were undertaken within the broader framework of Ottomanism, in which it was hoped that a stronger and more unified Ottoman society could be constructed through an embrace of cosmopolitanism, democracy, unionism, and liberalism. All right, so this is what everyone hoped was going to happen following the Young Turk Revolution. But of course, if you have done any sort of peeking ahead or are already familiar with this period, you will know that most of these hopes are going to slam into the cold, hard wall of reality pretty dang fast. And the next two decades will be most defined by a constant state of crisis, with massive political instability at home and near endless warfare with external foes. And in the face of these immense challenges, the leaders of the CUP, in particular Talat and Enver, will begin to feel that democracy, cosmopolitanism, feminism, liberalism, and even Ottomanism itself were maybe more of a hindrance than anything else, and were in fact standing directly in the way of their project to strengthen their empire. The first major challenge to the new government would come in October 1908, just 3 months after Ahmed Niazi had led his band of rebels into the hills of Monastir. This challenge would come not from reactionaries, parliamentary opponents, the Sultan, or the Sublime Porte bureaucracy, but instead, the challenge would come from abroad, as a rapid-fire sequence of events would suddenly challenge the status quo in the Ottoman Balkans. And within just a few days, the Ottoman Empire would suddenly lose huge swaths of territory as the jackals of Balkan nationalism and the wolves of European imperialism sense weakness following the revolution and decide to strike against the Ottoman sick man once more. The first to strike would be the Bulgarians, who would suddenly declare full independence from their Ottoman suzerain. Then, just one day later, Austria-Hungary would annex Ottoman Bosnia-Herzegovina. And then finally, leaders in Ottoman Crete would declare union with the Kingdom of Greece. These external threats would immediately put the revolutionary government on their heels, and the CUP would arguably never be able to recover and to find their proper footing ever again, as the empire would continue to face one existential threat after another for the next decade. So, next time we will be catching up with the old great powers of Europe and check in on what they have been up to since the Young Turk Revolution. Well, they have been up to quite a lot, and we are getting pretty dang close to that great cataclysm of world history called World War I, which will fundamentally change the Ottoman Empire, just as it will fundamentally change all the empires of the old world. And it's going to be a lot of fun tracing the events leading up to the Great War, because we on this podcast already know a ton about the causes of the Great War, which will be launched, no surprise here, as a result of great power meddling in formerly Ottoman lands in the Balkans, specifically in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So, next episode, we'll get back to that good old great power scheming and begin to trace the lead up to World War I. We discuss the Bosnian crisis.